Congratulations! You're listening to Congratulated Pine Show.
Coagulated pine trees.
Corrugated pine trust.
I like the word corrugated.
With Kate Rhodes.
And Maysoon Wazwaz.
So, a lot of MFA news this week, Mamie.
Yeah?
Well, the SFAI and CCA had their MFA shows, and as we know, they're forever locked in Mortal Kombat, and this year CCA came out on top.
I haven't seen them yet.
10-1.
10-1?
What does that mean?
I don't know.
Do you have a basketball term?
They won,
It was an upset. Cinderella story.
It was, in baseball, it's a sweep.
Other MFAs are not getting their MFA out there at USC down in Los Angeles, California.
Go Los Angeles!
This does not factor into the Bay versus LA, but I would say that I think this is a good move on
their
part.
This is a plus.
So what I read when I read with one eye the letter, sounds like they felt they were promised by the school all these things that the school didn't deliver on.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah, you were saying that Frances Stark pieced out of there.
She pieced out, and then I think the department...
I'd be pretty disappointed by that, for sure.
Yeah, the department, I think, was without a sort of director for the past year. Sounds like that person resigned in December 2014. They hadn't replaced it. I think I read somewhere... I should really clarify this, but I think I read somewhere that faculty from other departments were... sort of administering the classes. So like,
oh yeah, I heard that
like
too.
Faculty that weren't art department staff or anything were.
That the head of the department wasn't an art person.
Oh, okay, yeah. You know, right. It sounds like they had a year without studio visits from anyone.
That's crazy.
Which is crazy. In other situations, I know administration
that's
sort of
crazy.
Like bumped up, you know, the number of artists coming in and doing studio visits. Yeah. If the faculty weren't there, just
get some visiting.
Exactly.
Art lecture,
so it seems like they kind of, the administration dropped the ball on pulling that department together and, you know, trying their hardest to work with the students who were there who were inevitably going to be pissed off.
Hot damn.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Pretty interesting. I saw it, Hyperallergic posted something.
Oh, it's been getting around.
It's all over the place.
Hot news today.
Art Forum had a little blurb online.
Well, and the students put it out on eFlux.
I was just going to say, students put it out in Art and Education, which is big, gets all over the world, really.
What's going to happen, Maymay?
I don't know. I think it's definitely going to inform the, or impact the dialogue around art school in general, and school in general, and tuition. I think it's really exciting, actually, and inspiring. Because I keep telling students here, I'm like, you guys are the ones with the power here. I mean, I think we all are, but really the students as a collective unit have a pretty loud voice.
Yeah.
I mean, I work
it's
here
just once
for
you're
the students.
Locked in,
you know?
Like, I understand them doing all this because if they're going out, they got to go out big and make the most of it because they are locked into their loan debt no matter what. They've already taken the loan out.
Right.
So if they aren't going to continue,
they've taken it out
degree,
for the first
could,
year or for both years
get
or
something out of it. So I mean, it is kind of like once you're in it, you feel powerless, you know, once mm-hmm. you're in and you signed away for that money for the first big one, you don't feel powerful.
Well, I guess. Yeah. I mean, they're doing it at the end of the year. So they got 1 year out of grad school. Yeah. But.
Well, know, and this is huge. I mean, this is going to be bigger news than anybody who's graduating with the MFA.
I mean, I'm
right
waiting
now.
To hear to see what the school, like what their response is.
Yeah.
Because I think that will be
well,
telling,
they'll
certainly.
Probably just double down and get some good art department PR going and be like, we learned a lesson. Good job, USC.
Yeah.
The USC 7.
Let's get in touch with them.
Last thoughts about the USC 7?
Go USC. You think it's going to be called? Is it being called the USC 7?
That's
that
what I'm calling
like
it.
Sounds like a hardcore
no,
political.
They call the Corinthian 15 USC 7.
The political.
My only last thought is that I'm glad that they also like brought up the fact that, you know, this is all part of a bigger problem. Like that, you know, the adjunct faculty are expanding and full-time faculty are shrinking and there's less people there to advocate for better policies, better treatment of students.
It's a pretty fucking bold move. I mean, that's a lot. I think it's a huge thing for them to have done.
We're out here in the Presidio talking to Elizabeth Travelslight, artist, mathematician, one of the founders of the Bay Area Society for Art and Activism.
Hi, how's it going?
We have never met anyone at all, even tangentially involved in math. So we really wanted to ask you about that because it seems like a paradox is coming to life right here in front of us.
I did my undergraduate degree in mathematics at UC Santa Cruz in the late 90s. When you're an undergrad, probably at most liberal arts colleges, they want you to choose a major. They kind of insist upon it unless you're, you know, try to get savvy and do your independent study. And that just wasn't happening for me at UC Santa Cruz. So in the end, I decided to become a math major in part because I had some advanced placement credits from high school. And I realized that if I enrolled in the mathematics major, I would have more time for electives because the requirements for the degree, like, there just weren't as many compared to some of the other majors. And I mean, obviously, I wouldn't have done that if I didn't have some, like, fondness or affection and some skill with it. And so that's what I did. And I was a very difficult math student in the sense that I was. So I was at UC Santa Cruz in the late 90s. And, you know, I was, like, in my early 20s. And I'm taking classes with Donna Haraway and Angela Davis and kind of, like, yeah.
Fuck yeah.
And I was sort of experiencing this, you know, political awakening as, like, a woman of color, you know, really exploring, like, queer politics, and then going to my math classes every semester and just getting really grumpy and just being like, where's the politics? And, you know, really having a lot of critical questions about sort of the way the history of mathematics and kind of the political history of mathematics may have had some influence on the result that was requiring me to take, you know, group theory and complex analysis and all the different other requirements that I needed to complete my degree. So that's how I ended up with a math degree. I don't know if I can really consider myself a mathematician in the big M proper sense of the term. At this point, I mean, the mathematics really, I mean, it comes out in, like, a very different way that I think a math department would really, might not have a huge interest in.
So how'd you get into art?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I still kind of ask myself that question. How did this happen? Well, after I finished my math degree, the idea was like, oh, you know, if I study math and, like, that's, you know, universal, quote unquote, universal language, like, I could go in any direction. And it's like the universal language that hardly anyone speaks. I was, like, sort of done, like, wanted to take some time off from school. So I went to work at the Rainbow Grocery Cooperative here in San Francisco, which was, like, a good, like, sort of math application place because, like, as a collectively run business, you know, sort of being able to, like, manage the numbers of a business like that, I felt like my math skills were helpful, helped me add my time card most of the time, and didn't really think about school or art until, well, getting groceries are heavy, and the 30-pound box, like, really just as you get older, like, it just gets heavier and heavier. And started to think about things that I wanted to do besides groceries. I really loved working in a collective, but I was losing my passion, really, for lifting boxes. In your 20s, you can be really passionate about it and just totally feels, like, really enthusiastic. And so I started looking into graduate schools, and I ended up at this funny, somewhat, I don't know if the word is notorious, infamous, mysterious graduate school called the European Graduate School.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
I saw the bio, and it's like, I have no idea what that is.
Yeah, the rumors are true. The rumors are false. There are so many rumors about that school. And it's essentially, it's a distance learning program. So you can continue, like, your full-time job. It's designed so that you can continue your full-time job, do your coursework kind of on your own, October through May, and then the school holds a 3-week summer residency every summer for the first 2 years of the program, and then the third year of the program is, like, your writing year. And for some people, that's, like, an MA writing year for other people. It's a PhD writing year that, and sometimes that year goes, I mean, obviously, you know, that can go on and on. But so I did that for as a master's degree. They offer a degree in media and communication, which is kind of this like strategic misnomer because essentially it's a continental philosophy program that sort of looks at media and communication and film and art through this, you know, sort of historic tradition of European philosophy. And so I kind of took my interest in mathematics, particularly my interest in like the history of mathematics and science and sort of the political history. And that turned into this sort of larger interest in the, I think what I've sort of come to call like the material conditions for knowledge production. Mm-hmm. So looking at like, you know, the sort of easiest example I can give is, you know, like thinking about the way the anthropologist Benedict Anderson writes about paper and the way the newspaper was really instrumental in developing ideas of nationhood as like nation states started to become like the political organizing model in Europe and then around the world. And paper was, and the newspaper were really fundamental towards sort of creating that idea that you belonged while you in your remote village in some place suddenly also identified with belonging to like a country. Mm-hmm. So I was really interested in kind of the material things like paper and pencils. And I became really interested in text because when you study continental philosophy, the text is, gets really sexy and interesting for like a hot minute. And so when you spend a lot of time by yourself, because it's a distance learning program, you spend a lot of time by yourself thinking and reading a lot of continental philosophy, like your brain starts to like melt and you start having dreams about Derrida. And what I think what happened was I, you know, because it's, you know, kind of a, it's not an art program, but I think the realization that I had as I was sort of struggling with these questions around the material world and knowledge and community and the imagination, that what started to happen was rather than like instead of turning in like essays as they were assigned, I was turning in these like scanned paper objects because it didn't make sense to add more writing to the questions that were being asked because it just sort of it kept everyone in this like recursive loop of like reading and writing and text when I felt like if I really wanted to sort of bring my attention and call other people's attention to the material world, then focusing more on like material objects made more sense. So I started making art sort of through that process. And I was, interestingly, I was, this sort of comes back around to the math, because it was a distance learning program, I would use different libraries around the city to work. And I really just fell in love with working at the library at the San Francisco Art Institute because, you know, it has this like really nice view out on the quad. And I was working there on my thesis and still working at the grocery store. And I was just out on the quad one day and I was like, this seems like a really nice place to work. Mm. Like, how do you get a job in this building? Yeah, you know, I'm working on this like master's degree. I got this like undergraduate degree in mathematics. I was like, oh. You think they have math classes here? You think, awesome. Are there, yeah, artists need to study math. Everybody needs to study math. Totally. I'm like, I bet I could, I'd like to teach math here. And didn't even, it was kind of just like this, like, you know, thought as you're just like taking a break from your scholarly work of avoiding your writing of your thesis. And I mentioned this to Ralph Abraham, who was one of my math professors at UC Santa Cruz, really amazing, lovely person. And he looked at me and he just said, Danum, Danum, Danum. And I was like, oh, is he swearing at me? Like, what is he saying? He clarified and came to learn that he was talking about the Digital Art New Media program at UC Santa Cruz. That was at that point, probably just finishing its third or fourth year as a program. And, you know, he thought I would be a really great fit for the program. And it kind of, you know, the invitation to apply sort of came at like a good time in my life personally. And he's, you know, like, yeah, you know, MFA. And then you'd have like a terminal teaching degree and you could teach math to art students. It'd be great. And I was kind of like, oh, yeah, that sounds good. And still didn't really have, you know, by then I was friends with Christine Wong Yap, who I know you know, Maysoon. And she was sort of like my insider into the art world. Like she and I had become friends like in 1999 and would occasionally like go to her exhibitions or she'd like take me on field trips to things. So I was like interested in making art, but didn't really know a lot about it. And so this seemed like a good, you know, interestingly, like I went, you know, I went into my MFA, you know, wanting to like graduate so I could teach math to art students. Like sort of the making of the art was kind of this, you know, sort of awesome, delicious side dish that I didn't really know a lot about. It's not like I don't come from a family, you know, my mother immigrated here from the Philippines, and I don't come from a family that has like a lot, huge background in the fine arts. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I was accepted into the Digital Art New Media program at UC Santa Cruz and sort of learned a lot more about, you know, studio practice. And I mean, interestingly, that program is very sort of like social practice, like conceptually framed. So there isn't a lot. And plus it's, you know, it's a digital art program. So it has a very different lineage than the fine arts. You know, it kind of comes out of more of the like, you know, technology sciences and, you know, maker culture and things like that. So kind of the way, you know, digital art and media meets the fine arts is, I mean, that's kind of an interesting conversation in and of itself. I finished my MFA and really found kind of, you know, my community of art making friends and really loved it. And interestingly, after I graduated, I had kind of forgotten about the original goal of teaching math to art students. And then a couple years after I graduated, kind of through a series of references and friends connected with SFAI, they offered me a class. And I was like, oh, right. And this was like 7 years after kind of the initial like, hey, I think I might want to do this. And I had just, I don't know, forgotten. And I was like, that's right. And so I just finished my fourth semester there. It's been good.
So the whole time you're doing this stuff, are you also like doing activism and like community organizing stuff?
Had always, you know, felt, you know, as an undergrad at UC Santa Cruz became like very like politicized and very proud of that tradition. I think the 90s at UC Santa Cruz was like a really amazing time to be there. You know, a lot of the founding faculty were really sort of at this incredible time in their careers because they were sort of now, you know, a lot of them have really gone emerita, have retired. But in the 90s, they were sort of just really at this height where they'd sort of even moved past kind of like the hard celebrated work of their careers and were kind of working on like their pleasure projects and, you know, really just enjoying their work as professors. And I felt like I benefited so much from them. And then working in a worker co-op, obviously, is really political. I was really involved with the network of Bay Area worker cooperatives and really interested kind of in the labor politics of collectives. I was a founding member of a group at Rainbow that was called the Anti-Oppression Working Group, which was something a group of workers started to start to try to address kind of some of the issues that come up when you have like a really diverse workforce and are, you know, even though we're in San Francisco and it's Rainbow, like are still really vulnerable to all of the institutionalized and cultural aspects of oppression that are part of, you know, global American culture. The Bay Area Society for Art and Activism came about in the summer, or no, it was really like the early winter, late fall of 2013, which was kind of after that, like, first intense summer of evictions, right? It was really when all of it, you know, I think Rebecca Solnit wrote her Google Bus piece for the London Review of Books in like February of 2013. And then like the first Google protest was maybe in like December of 2013. And in, I think, September of 2013, Guillermo Gomez Pena, who I've been a long admirer of, he wrote this open letter to the arts community in the Bay Area in response to the eviction of Renee and Cynthia and Rio and Yolanda, that family. Mm-hmm. And that was really kind of like a huge wake-up call for me about kind of the turn that San Francisco was taking. So I grew up in San Francisco. You know, besides the time I lived in Santa Cruz, I've pretty much been here my whole life. And had really wanted to raise my daughter in San Francisco because of the diversity and the arts community and the sort of progressive liberal politics that have really characterized the city. And then suddenly, you know, she was maybe 4 or 5 months old when I read this letter. And it was just so intense to sort of read that letter and be like nursing her and looking at her and just suddenly realizing, like, what city are you going to really grow up in? Like, if there's, you know, if the city can't support the work of such talented, celebrated artists and cultural workers who have really, like, framed and shaped the city to be the kind of beacon that it is creatively and politically, it just seemed kind of, I don't know, it really felt strange. Like, I just didn't know if it, what kind of city she would grow up in. And so around this time, I had, was like recently unemployed, and my husband suggested I, you know, spend some of my, you know, many, many hours of nursing thinking about some of the kind of, you know, the kind of work I would like to be doing, you know, when it was time for me to go back to work. Because maybe, you know, I had a lot of flexibility. My daughter was small enough that, you know, I had some time on my hands. She was portable. You know, she's a toddler now. It's like very difficult to take her anywhere. But at the time, she was really small and slept a lot. And it, so it seemed like a good time to try to think strategically and to talk to people about something that might be a strategic sort of intervention into this sort of crisis period that became so obvious. And that seemed, and kind of sort of through that kind of meditation, I kind of just like looked up a couple days later and was like, I think it's the Bay Area Society for Art and Activism. And I spent probably the next 6 months just talking to people and just asking if people thought it was a good idea. I think, you know, there's a lot of arts organizations that do social justice work. Mm-hmm. But they tend to be sort of like focused around like particular cultures and nothing that's really or particular like institutions and spaces. Mm-hmm. But nothing that really sort of seemed to just work at the level of like these values in this region in a really broad way. If anybody knows of anything, they should just like email me. Mm-hmm. Love to meet them. Because I'm not interested in like doubling people's work, but more just like supporting the work that's already been done. And ultimately, you know, the mission is really framed around cultivating these values and then also providing like really tangible resources and opportunities to the artists and activists who do this kind of work. Mm-hmm. I mean, kind of in the spectrum of artists who get paid for making their art, and you have like kind of like the spec, you know, at one end of the spectrum, you have the artists that do, you know, social practice, social justice kinds of work, and often, right, that work is unpaid, but it has just like such, I think, significant social benefit. Mm-hmm. in so many different ways. So I started talking to people, and I got some really amazing people to agree to be on an advisory council, which is like less intense than being on a board of directors, but, you know, lending their names and their reputations kind of to the mission of the organization. And SOMART's Cultural Center agreed to be our fiscal sponsor so we could start fundraising. And as soon as we started fundraising, we started designing programs and events and trying to turn that those raised funds back around to the performers and the artists that are providing the programs. And that's where we are now, pretty much.
We got a letter in last week from a listener, and I thought maybe you would have a good response to this. Okay, this is an excerpt. Social fucking justice. Why does it seem so taboo to talk about it in relation to art? Why isn't everyone talking about it? Do people think that talking about it like it's a normal thing would water it down? Are people afraid of being called out as posers? What are people afraid of? I thought maybe you would have some two cents to pop into that.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time thinking about the way art and social justice like go together. One of the things I really have been enjoying about the Bay Area Society for Art and Activism in sort of, you know, this first year where it's just like very open and experimental and nobody is really sure if it's going to take off or, you know, what's next, has been to just really kind of, you know, back to this umbrella, like open it really wide and be really open to the different ways art and social justice can come together or work together. And I don't know, so when you're thinking about the question, I'm not quite sure where the questioner is coming from, but I think
they are
into it and wish there was more people. But I think they're also, but I think they're definitely coming from more the academic gallery, you know, exhibition art.
So I think there is a way in which sometimes social, like art that deals with social justice issues comes across as like didactic and then gets kind of funneled into, you know, a world called like community-based art, which I love and celebrate and spent, you know, many years working in. But I think it's not, it's, you know, sometimes put up as being like antithetical to, you know, the glamorous, sexy world of, you know, the commercial art, high art, fine art. And so one of the things I was talking about with my students last semester, we were reading, we were supposed to be reading Grant Kester's Contemporary Collaborative Art in a Global Context, or The One in the Many, I think is the title. And then the subtitle is Contemporary Collaborative Art in a Global Context. And he has these very thick early chapters about the way post-structuralism sort of got imported from Europe into, you know, the rooms and theories of art criticism and art theory in the United States. And this way that we find ourselves in this situation where, you know, for people who are working, you know, okay, so community art aside, for people who are kind of working in this, you know, commercial fine art or high art context, like on the one hand, it's like really considered kind of in vogue to be dealing with issues of like labor and class, difference, politics, all of these things. But then you're still kind of in the position where you need to make it palatable to potential buyers, most of whom are high net worth individuals. Mm. I don't know how effective kind of political art at that level is. Like, I think it's a very twisted place in which to be political, because if you're really interested in sort of the commercial aspects of it, then at the end of the day, you're kind of beholden to potential sellers. You know, there's so much that, you know, activists and artists, in some ways, like they have so much in common in the sense that they're both sort of working with the raw material of the present and sort of creating, you know, sort of vision and inspiration for like something that doesn't exist yet, but working towards that vision of like what could be. And sometimes those things are, you know, can be aligned with like larger visions that include kind of the improved conditions for a large number of people. And I think that's really great. But I think it's often, yeah, I think it's considered kind of unsexy because it's not commercial. But I mean, it's often because, you know, so much of the work is like anti-capitalist. So
I think that's an interesting kind of thing to be, to tease out of the art world, that I think is like you guys put together the panel, the super panel, mm-hmm. with Ben Davis, who wrote 9.5 Theses on Art in Class. And that was like a big part of his thing, that like art can also act as kind of like a vent for people's like political frustration.
Well, I think so. You know, one of the things that Ben said at that panel that I really loved and I've sort of been continuing to reflect on is, I think sometimes we think that like art is going to like change the world. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Ben really emphasizes in 9.5 Theses on Art in Class is, you know, what's going to like change the world, right, is like direct action and activism and like the political work that, you know, is needed to actually transform institutions and policies. And so Ben really reframed that question, like, how can art change the world, and transformed it into like, you know, how can the world change art? Because that's really, you know, I think where he finds the most like interesting and exciting things happening is like when like the politics of the world sort of make their way into the like quote unquote art world where he works as a critic, and, you know, impact it in such a way that the art becomes, you know, sort of breaks out of kind of the stasis of the commercial capitalist mm-hmm. art market, and starts to create things that are really exciting and interesting.
Things that maybe we would consider, that maybe we wouldn't always classify as art, but maybe like visual culture. Like, I remember him talking about the If They Shot Me Down hashtag mm-hmm. and how that was like hugely impactful, like maybe more so than a lot of like sanctioned art might have been at that time.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what BASA has coming up? Or
So we actually try not to use the acronym. Sorry. Yeah, it's okay. It's like it's a branding thing because we're brand new. So we just say all the words Bay Area Society for Art and Activism until, like, you know, years from now when everybody, or for short, sometimes we just say the society, which sometimes has like a poetic, slightly ominous like tone. But yeah, the Bay Area Society for Art and Activism, what we have next. Well, right now we're in the middle of a two-city, what we're calling a parallel exhibition called The Dissidents, the Displaced, and the Outliers, curated by the amazing Dorothy Santos. So she brought a group of artists together for the exhibition, the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project, Eliza Barrios, collaboration between Colleen Flaherty and Matteo Batanti, called, they go by Kaleo, Leslie Dreyer, Tom Laughlin, and myself. As part of our curatorial partnership model, we're working with the Electronic Frontier Foundation to sort of raise awareness about their work. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, they're based in San Francisco. I think because they sort of work on the digital or the electronic frontier, like they don't necessarily get acknowledged as a local organization, but trying to bring them into sort of more local context. And they're going to be... Nadia Kayali of EFF is going to be leading a digital privacy workshop at Random Parts on May 23rd. And we're going to have a closing panel discussion on June 14th at Incline Gallery. So we have programming at both Random Parts in Oakland and Incline Gallery in San Francisco. And that's been a really exciting pairing. You know, Incline Gallery is located at kind of like... Ground Zero, San Francisco, gentrification. I mean, it's almost like, I don't know, people keep calling it, is it like post-gentrification? Post-post? Like people don't even, that's in one location. And then Random Parts is a really lovely little house gallery in East Oakland that is kind of on the back end of the curve of gentrification. Like, is it going to be gentrified? Like, it's, you know, there are speculators who come in and kind of want to rebrand the neighborhood as like an art district, you know. And one of the artists, I was talking to her at the opening at Random Parts, and she's like, this neighborhood so reminds me of Valencia Street when I first moved there in the 90s. It was like a very mixed, you know, working class, middle income neighborhood. And, you know, really Valencia Street's just isn't that anymore. Like, it's sort of something else altogether. And so I think having the exhibition with this theme kind of in these two locations, for people who can visit both locations, I really would encourage them to go visit both locations, because I think it will be really interesting to sort of see different works by the artists kind of in these different geographic locations and think about kind of the way those two spaces are related to each other through the themes that the artists are exploring.
I like to always ask if you have anything else you personally would like listeners to know.
Oh, gosh. Not that I can think of off the top of my head. Well, I will say, if I put on my executive staff hat for the Bay Area Society for Art and Activism, if your listeners are interested in becoming members, anyone can become a member. You just have to make a donation of any amount. We suggest a donation of $24 to $360 as an annual membership contribution. But people give $5 and we make them members. And they can go to artandactivism.org to learn more.
Thank you so much for talking to us today. And as always, congratulations.
Thanks. It's been a lot of fun. Looking forward to future conversations.
I could talk to you for 100 hours.
Hey there, this is Kate from the future. As sometimes happens, we got a little email post-interview from Elizabeth Travelslight, so I just wanted to read to you a little bit of addendum to that interview. This is from her. The relationship between art and activism, back to the listener question, is a huge topic, and I'm afraid I didn't do it justice and am myself still learning about how they do and don't work together. One thing I feel like is worth mentioning is the fact that politically engaged art is often critical, and this comes across as unpleasant, which many people don't like. This review of Okwi Inwezor's selection for the 2015 Venice Biennale is a perfect example. The article is called Oqui Inwisors, 56th Venice Biennale is Morose, Joyless, and Ugly by Benjamin Ginocchio. Link in the underworld. Anyhow, that review is a perfect example. This is back to Elizabeth Singh. My response to this would be to consider the social economic privileges that create and allow for a presence for, or even insistence on, pleasure. In the context of global capitalism, many quote-unquote pleasant experiences come at a significant unpleasant cost to others, and pleasure and capitalism can work to mask that cost. Which isn't to say that socially engaged art can't or shouldn't work at the register of celebration, beauty, joy, or other good feelings. Many of it does. I just don't think it has to apologize for not doing so. Also, I didn't have the opportunity to verbally redact everything that I said. Do I need to? I think I should, just in case. I verbally redact everything I just said. Thanks. All the best, Elizabeth. That was, from my point of view, a great interview. I'd love to have her on the show again. Let us know what you think. You know how to contact us. And now on with the show. For some reason, after leaving the Presidio, we decided that we needed to go stalk Mark Zuckerberg because I heard that he lived near Dolores Park, and I heard that his house was always under construction. So we're over here by Dolores Park looking for houses under construction.
We're on the corner of Dolores and Liberty currently, and there is a backhoe. Is that a backhoe?
Yep.
A backhoe and a porta potty directly in front of us. However, we don't really see any scaffolding, and you kind of need some kind of scaffolding if we're working on a house, usually. There's no boarded up windows.
I don't think it would be. I think he's living in the house, too, so I think it's just like they're constantly doing renovations.
Oh, there's someone in an Audi behind us. Maybe we should ask them if they know, because they probably do know.
Excuse me? Do you happen to know where Mark Zuckerberg lives?
What? Who?
Mark Zuckerberg?
I'm sorry, I don't know. I didn't move here.
Oh, okay. Thank you anyway.
Welcome.
Have a great day.
The Google bus just drove by, but it didn't stop on the corner where we are, so I'm wondering if we should just follow the Google bus for a little bit.
I don't think Zucker is on the Google bus.
He's definitely not on the Google bus. He's probably still at work.
I think go straight.
You're just wasting time.
Maysoon, is that him?
Is that him?
No, that guy's too young.
What about that dog? Is that his dog?
I don't think he has a dog.
Look at this guy
Hope,
in that car.
Hope, got a runner. No. He has curly hair. Uh-oh. More porta potties.
Porta potties?
Oh, it could be any of these. Oh, these look posh as hell.
Let's put the hazards on. Can you see in any of the windows? Should we go check the mailbox?
That's a federal crime. So if we do that, we can't say it.
Opening the mail is a federal crime. Looking at a piece of paper is not a federal crime.
I think rifling through someone's mail could put us in some kind of legal jeopardy.
Looking at a piece of paper. Get out and look at the paper.
No, hell no. Are you nuts? First off, it's not under construction. Excuse me. Do you know where Mark Zuckerberg lives?
Somewhere around here, though.
That's what we've heard.
We're still finding him. I'm sure you have some questions for him.
Yes.
I do, too.
Oh, yeah. Could you tell us the question to ask?
I tried to get off Facebook, and it wasn't possible. I ended up finding out. I'm not very savvy with these kinds of things, but, you know, it seemed very easy for me to just, like, select the wrong... Yes, I want to read this message out of my email, and suddenly everything that I ever had on Facebook just reappeared. I thought perhaps if you close an account, they delete all the information that you would put in your profile, but it's all still there, so there's really no such thing as...
And it's all theirs,
actually.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Have a
great evening.
Okay. Zuck,
I feel like if we were in Ohio, I don't know if people would be so excited to speak to us.
San Francisco.
Straight up...
People are
roll up on somebody in a Toyota, ask them about Facebook, pop a microphone in their face, and sure enough, they're going to give you the hospitality.
I think the microphone makes us seem legit. It makes us seem like we're doing some reporting here, people. Okay, Kate.
I think it also helps that we're pretty innocuous looking.
Yeah, we're like, we look like kind of normal young ladies.
Hipsters.
I don't think we look hip.
Oh. We look like hipsters.
I think he's in this Rose building.
For some
Zuck!
Reason.
Hey, Zuck! We've got some questions for you. Oh, I'm scared of him. Are you sure? Really?
No, no, no. I'm scared too. I'm scared too now that you said that.
Oh, I'm scared.
What if that's his dad? No, keep going, keep going.
Congratulations!
You listened to another episode of Congratulations Pine Tree. I don't know how you did it. Good job.
Good job, guys. Let us know if it's becoming painful.
I edited this episode in Tacoma, Washington.
Yay.
Let me know if you can hear a difference.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, listeners. Have a great end of May. Have a great beginning of June. It's not going to be. We have a whole other episode going up before that.
It's only mid-month.
Have a great end of May. Thank you. Good night.